towards the cross of Calvary through the Gospel of Mark. Hard to believe that a year and a half ago we started in this series of Mark, and now we are coming down to the very end. Now, one of the things that we're going to see in our text today is it's very, very short. It's only nine verses long. And it is probably in the Lord's life, I would say, probably 6 minutes of his life. About 6 minutes. 6 to 7, perhaps. Maybe not. I wouldn't think it would be much more than that. It is the arrest of Jesus Christ by the religious leaders and Pharisees and high priest. And it is him surrendering himself to these people. Now, when we look at Mark's gospel, we don't see a lot that stands out to us. There's not a lot in these nine verses that really make us take notice. It's just a record of him being arrested. But when we compare Mark's gospel with Matthew and with Luke and with John, suddenly this 6 minute or 7 minute window suddenly takes on a totally different look. And today I want to examine it through that lens. I want to show you that there is more proof in this idea that God is doing something that is supernatural. And what we're going to see today is absolutely supernatural. And so I just want to get you ready for this, because as we get ready to take our text, I want you just to strap on your seatbelts, because I think it's going to be that extraordinary today. Now let's look at beginning at verse 43 of Mark's Gospel, chapter 14. Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." Now, Matthew and Luke, they all agree with Mark here. This is exactly how their gospels begin. It tells us the story. Now, Mark was the first gospel that was written. John's gospel was the last one. And John tells us something a little differently. He remembers it differently. Look at this with me. John chapter 18, starting at verse 2. "Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place, because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, 'Who is it you want?'" Notice first that John mentions that Judas knows this place, knows it because he has been there himself. He is the betrayer. He is going to betray his Lord, and he knows of this place called Gethsemane, this grove of olive trees where this olive press is located. He knows exactly where it's at. And not only that, but we also see that Judas is the one who chose the place to betray Jesus. What was the one thing, if you remember, as we've been reading through Mark, what was the one thing that the Pharisees and the Sadducees and religious leaders and the high priest were all afraid of? Otherwise, they would have arrested Jesus. Do you remember what it was? It was the crowds of people. It was the people they were afraid of, because they saw Jesus one way, and the people saw Jesus another way. They saw that Jesus was not a prophet, that he was not the Son of God, that he was not the Messiah, that everything he did was from the hand of the devil. And they hated it because Jesus exposed their own hypocritical lifestyle. And so they wanted to get even with him. They wanted to shut him up. But notice here that the people didn't see Jesus that way. Jesus had healed many of them. Jesus had helped them. Jesus had reached his hands out and touched them when they should never have been taught or touched because of the law. Many of them were lepers and sick, and nobody wants to touch. I mean, all you got to do is look around. We used to shake hands here, but now we're bumping elbows with everybody, because nobody wants to touch someone who's sick, but Jesus touched them, laid his hands on them, and healed them. And so they saw Jesus as a great man of God, a man who had come from God, a man who was a prophet, And some even believe the Messiah. My friends, it's amazing, isn't it, that these educated people, these educated priests, these people who had power and prestige, looked at the common person as someone who had to be protected because of their incompetence. Kind of see that in our political system today, don't we? I mean, things really haven't changed that much. And so the one thing that they had to do is they had to arrest Jesus in a secluded spot, and Judas knew exactly where that was. The next thing I just wonder about here is what happened when Jesus suddenly appeared out of the grove of trees and surprised Judas and that band of men. Because they were planning on surprising Jesus and the disciples. But it says that Jesus, who knew all but what was going on, went out and met them and asked them, "Who is it that you want?" Now look at what the reply is. Verse 5. "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied, "is who they're looking for." And Jesus replied, "I am he." And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Now, in the original Greek manuscripts, your Bible is not accurate, by the way. Most of you have the same thing I just read. That word "he" was put there by English translators because we have to have a definite article at the end of that phrasing. But that's not how or what Jesus said. What Jesus said in the Greek was "ago ami," which simply translated means "I am." And when Jesus said "I am," I just want to remind you of something that God said to Moses. Moses asked God, "Who should I say is sending me to the Israelites? What if they ask me?" And God answered Moses and said, "Tell them, I am is sending you." My friends, today that word in the Hebrew is not spoken by the Jews because they see that word as a very holy, holy name. And when Jesus said this, it says that involuntarily, Judas, who was with this rabble, all took a step backwards involuntarily, and the Greek word says they were thrusted down. That is, they fell prostrate before him. Jesus Christ, being the Son of God, said, "I am," and instantly they had to fall. My friends, the reality is that this is mentioned here in John's Gospel because the Bible tells us that one day every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is the Son of God to the glory of the Father. And my friends, this is absolutely amazing that it is recorded. And why is it recorded? Well, perhaps we were talking last week how Jesus had come back to the three, Peter, James, and John, and he had come back for the third time and said, "Are you guys still sleeping?" And maybe then all of a sudden Jesus just says, "Oh, it's too late. Here comes the betrayer." And maybe John is the only one who got up to see what he was talking about. But for some reason, John sees this thing happen. And this could have happened just like that. It couldn't have taken much time at all. But whatever the case, whatever, if you want to discount it or not discount it, the reality is that it just proves one more time a theme that has been happening as we have been working our way through this gospel. And that is this, that Jesus Christ, that God, and not the darkness, the forces of darkness, but God alone was in charge here. I think it's amazing that the betrayer has to fall and bow before him. That the ones who were going to arrest him and perhaps even beat him were the ones who had to fall before him. God is in charge, not the forces of darkness. And this operation has been planned from the very beginning, and it is being fulfilled every step of the way. Now, what we see here to me is so amazing because in John's Gospel, chapter, let's continue to read it. It says, again, he asked them, "Who is it that you want?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth. I told you that I am he." Now he's added other words and it doesn't have the same connotation. Jesus answered, "If you're looking for me, then let these men go. This happened so that the words of that he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave me." Now let me just ask you this question. How is it that Jesus Christ was able to fulfill so many prophecies? How is it that one man was able in his life to fulfill every prophecy? I mean, even if the man knew all the words and all the prophecies and set out to have a list and check them off, the reality is that there were prophecies about Jesus that were fulfilled before he was even born. That Jesus would be born in a Bethlehem. I don't know about you. I can't plan where I was born. I was born in Boston. People think that's really weird. I had to get my driver's license renewed the other day, and I took my birth certificate in there because they've got a new requirement. If you get your new license, you're going to have to go through this whole rigmarole and prove who you are. But let me tell you, when they pulled out that birth certificate from Massachusetts, that lady looked at it like I was some kind of liar. What is this? Well, it's really old, number one. And number two, all the seals have faded. And number three, who around here comes from Massachusetts? Not too many. And she looked at it like somehow I had made it up. But the reality is I did not make it up. Jesus could not have made it up either. How could he have chosen that the Messiah, the Savior, would come out of Bethlehem? How would he be able to do that? He couldn't have done that. There had to be some pre-planning and some things that happened behind the scenes. And my friends, the only answer is, he is the Son of the living God. And my friends, we see this. And I just think it's amazing that the reason that this happened was because there is a purpose. The scriptures had to be fulfilled. Look at this next verse in Mark, going back to our text, verse 45. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Now, none of the Gospels tell us who this person is. We don't even know the name of this person until we read John's Gospel. John tells us the servant's name was Malchus, and that the man who cut his ear off was Peter. Now, most scholars believe that the Gospel that we have been studying, the Gospel of Mark here, was actually dictated by Peter to Mark, and that Mark added some of his own stories in here as well. So if that's the case, perhaps Peter was a little too embarrassed about this moment in his life. I mean, let's face it, we don't tell everything about our life, especially the things that don't really benefit us too well. Peter doesn't talk about this. He doesn't mention it. And perhaps he's afraid that he's going to be arrested for the crime. Oh, so you're the one who... Okay, we're going to take you in. But by the time John wrote his gospel, we know that Peter had already been martyred. So perhaps John tells the story because there's no way they can persecute Peter any more than they had. Matthew alone records that Jesus healed Malchus' ear. And we don't know how that happened. We don't know if he took the ear, put it back on the side of his head, and super glued it only as God could. I don't know how it happened. I just know that Matthew tells us that his ear was made whole. So we see all kinds. And in fact, this is the last healing that we'll see in the gospel record. It's also in Matthew that we see Jesus make a statement that we do not see in Mark or any of the other Gospels. Look at this in Matthew with me. Matthew 26, verse 52. "Put your sword back in its place," Jesus said to him, "for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen in this way?" You see, Jesus gives us a glimpse of his backup. Being a former officer of the law, I enjoy the idea of having backup. Knowing who your backup is, knowing that I'm going to work with so-and-so and he's 6'8", is going to help me feel a lot more confident when I go into a fight. I feel confident because he's a big guy and I can sneak around and do all the things I need to do if we get into a fight. But Jesus shows us here the reality of the fact that there at his disposal were 12 legions of angels. That means 6,000 strong in each legion. That means 72,000 angels. And can I tell you, for just Judas and that little band of rabble, I don't think he needed 72,000. I think one would have done the job. Some scholars believe that there were a contingent of Roman soldiers that were standing by, that they probably were told about this person who was going to betray Rome and do all these nasty things. And so they might have had a contingent there. They might have had, 50 soldiers. But I think with a couple more angels, we could have cleaned up the whole place. I want to just say this to you. Who's in control here? I mean, when we have seen what we've seen to this point, who's in control? Who's the player? And who's the pawns? I mean, can I just suggest to you right now that none of us really have a clue or a beginning of an inkling of just how much power and authority our God has. There are moments when we see a glimpse of it. There's a moment where we realize that God loves us and we get a glimpse of it. But the Bible tells us one day, my friends, those who are born again will come and see him face to face. And at that moment, every tear you've ever cried, every struggle you've ever had, will not matter at all because of his wonder and glory and splendor and that overwhelming sense that he absolutely loves you. My friends, one day, we're going to see him. And every trial and every hurt will mean nothing. It'll be just a distant memory as we enjoy the presence of God. Now let's read out the rest of our text here. Then everyone deserted him and fled. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. Scholars believe that this is John Mark, the one who is writing this gospel, that he kind of put this little story there because it happened to him. And the reason they believe it's him, because he was a man of means. They believe that perhaps this olive grove was actually one of his relatives. But there is another camp that believes this man is Lazarus. That Lazarus, who Jesus raised from the dead, is this man. He was also a man of means. But I have a little issue with that. Because everything I've ever read about people who have died on the operating table, who have claimed to see and have this near-death experience, they have one thing in common, all of them. I'm not talking just a few, I'm talking all of them. And that is this: they never are afraid to die again. So I don't think it was Lazarus. So I think Lazarus would have stayed with Jesus. But it probably was John Mark. Now, this week we've had some terrible bad news. We've had news of one of the giants passing away, going to heaven, Billy Graham. And I wonder, who's going to take his place? Will God raise another like him? Or was that the last one? Will there be no one else like him that will reach across the globe like he did and touch so many lives? Then we had the opposite. We had the bad but good news of Billy Graham. But then we had the terrible news of Florida. 17 people losing their lives in another shooting. It's amazing, because when you look at that shooting, you think to yourself, you have such a different picture. You have pictures of coaches and teachers throwing themselves in front of the students to protect them and save them. People who are willing to lay their life down for people that they cared for and were paid to care for. But not only did they just get paid to care, but they did care. And we know that because they laid their life down. Then we see those officers. And let me just say this before I go any further. I have a right to critique another officer. The news media does not. Until you go up to a vehicle or a situation where you know there's an armed assailant and put your life on the line, no one should be able to ridicule anybody in that situation. Brad can. I can. Those who served in the military and put their life on the line, they can. But until you find yourself in that position, you should not ridicule them. And you should not get upset with them. But let me tell you what I saw was just terrible. Officers sworn to uphold, and now we found out there's just not one, but there were more, that would not go in and confront a young boy, and that's what he was, just a punk, mixed up, and not confront him and allow him to continue to fire. What a picture that is. Teachers without guns throwing their bodies in front of him that some might escape. And officers with guns who would not go in and take a chance at being killed. My friends, you know what we see here. We are reminded again of this fact that Jesus Christ willingly laid down his life for you and for me and for people who don't care.